The Pre-Paces podcast is brought to you by two brilliant sponsors. Paces Ahead is a fantastic four-day face-to-face Paces course run in Brentford, London. They bring you a whole host of patients with fascinating stories and reliable signs, and these patients are absolutely delighted to allow you to hone your exam skills prior to exam day. Some of the patients actually are used in the exams themselves, and the next courses are running from the 20th to the 23rd of May, and then I will be helping out on the course running on the 28th to the 31st of May. Please do come and say hello. I'd love to have a chat and hopefully help you on your way to passing your paces. But if you can't make the course for whatever reason, our other sponsor, Pass Test, has got you covered with their market-leading online revision resource. There are tons of videos which help you revise from the comfort of your own home, and most listeners that I've spoken to have said this is equally essential for your paces success. But that's enough for me for now. Let's get into this week's episode of the Pre-Paces podcast. Welcome back, listeners, to another episode of the Pre-Paces podcast. I'm Dr. Sam Williams, and today we have a fantastic show on our hands with a brilliant guest, Dr. Phil Berry, consultant hepatologist at Guy's and St. Thomas's Hospital in London. Phil was a fantastic guest, and his experience in treating patients with liver disease cannot be understated. In this episode, we cover off the examination of our patient, the presentation of the case back to the examiner, and the differential diagnosis. Finally, the generosity of the Buy Me A Coffee donators simply knows no bounds. The massive thank yous this week are to Sandy, who recently passed after she told us she had a former podcast guest as one of her examiners. Thank you as well to Chris, who donated as a first-time passer. Thank you to CL, and thank you to Dar and Pat, who also passed after listening to the pod. You're all wonderful people, and as always, I'm humbled by your generosity. Congratulations on all your pace of success. But without further ado, let's get into this week's episode. Welcome to the Pre-Paces podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sam Williams, and in this episode, it's one of the Paces biggies. This is one of the really common stations which we know comes up so frequently in Paces, and that is chronic liver disease. Joining us today, we have another fantastic expert guest. He is a consultant gastroenterologist and hepatologist at Guy's and St. Thomas's NHS Foundation Trust in London. Not only that, but he is a prolific blogger and author. His blog, Illusions of Autonomy, which I will drop a link to in the show notes, closely examines many topical issues facing us as practicing clinicians today in the UK. We're delighted to welcome to the show Dr. Phil Berry. So, Phil, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Sam. It's great to be here.
And Phil will also be taking on our regular feature of Quiz the Consultant. This is the quiz where our bosses take on a quickfire quiz on a topic of their own choosing with a caveat that it can't be related to medicine. So, Phil, what have you chosen as your specialist subject?
I've chosen the only subject that, you know, I really apply myself to with lifelong learning and have a lifetime's worth of experience in, and that is Star Wars.
I absolutely love this topic, and I cannot wait for that. That's going to be coming up a little bit later in the show, and I'm sure we'll have more to talk about when it comes to that. But for now, myself and all the listeners are Padawan learners, thirsty for knowledge from a Jedi master. So let's get into this Paces topic of chronic liver disease. So Phil, I wonder if we can start off with some physiology, some basic definitions. So what exactly is chronic liver disease?
Well, the clues in on the packet, it's long-term liver disease, especially in relation to PACES. We're looking at patients with long-term problems who are stable enough to come to the hospital or the venue. And essentially, we're talking about fibrosis of the liver, accumulated scarring of the liver from whichever etiology, that is, resulting in progression to cirrhosis, which is when you begin to get the signs and the symptoms and the manifestations of chronic liver disease. So for our purposes, there are other sort of nuances around post-transplantation and scars and other conditions such as polycystic disease, say, which don't fit in that category. For our purposes, we're talking about patients with established cirrhosis.
Yeah, fantastic. And as you mentioned, it ticks some of the PACES boxes, which means these patients have long-term, it's a long-term condition with likely relatively stable signs that are able to make their way to the PACES venues. And the most likely place where our listeners are most likely to see these cases is going to be in an abdominal examination station. Obviously, it may be relevant in the other stations, such as the clinical consultations, but we're going to be focusing on this in the pure examination station, which from the new PACES format will be a station 4, which is the 6 minutes of examination and then 4 minutes of presentation and examiner questions. So we're going to put ourselves in the shoes of our listeners as candidates going through their pure abdominal examination station. So Phil, just starting off, we're going to be starting off at the end of the bed with our end of the bed inspection of our patients. So what do our listeners need to look out for from the end of the bed to maybe give a clue that our patient may have a form of chronic liver disease?
I mean, the experienced hepatologist would maybe spot it from the door. Many of our listeners will have seen the classic end-stage liver disease patient who is borderline malnourished or sarcopenic, so looking thin with wasted muscles. And it's often especially evident in the arms and around the shoulders with a drawn, you know, expression and sunken cheeks. But not all patients look like that. You know, others are earlier on in their journey. You may see abdominal swelling even under the bed sheets or under the clothing to point you to the possibility of ascites even before you lay hands on. And as you get a little bit closer, you might start to pick up some of the cutaneous signs that we're going to talk about in more detail. Patients may be clearly jaundiced, clearly, but they are unlikely to be, you know, acutely confused or encephalopathic in an examination setting. And maybe we'll talk about some of the sort of more subtle cutaneous signs as we go forward.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are some clues which we'll be able to spot from the end of the bed, but obviously we're going to be proceeding through the examination in a stepwise fashion. So once we've done our end of the bed examination, we're going to be typically moving to the hands. And this is where you can get a good number of signs to look out for. And I guess the thing which I'll remind listeners is it's not critical maybe to list every single sign that you've seen from the during the examination, but you do need to pick up on at least several of these signs and report them back to the examiner, because clusters of these signs will demonstrate you've got a clear understanding of what is commonly found in these patients. So, Phil, what sort of signs are often found in the hands of these patients?
I think the most common probably are palmar erythema, so redness around the palms. And I find still a good way to detect that is to compare it to your own palm. That sort of controls for the temperature of the room and for a normal person. The Dupuytren's is nonspecific, but that thickening of the tissues in the palm of the hand is also very common. And sometimes it's quite marked. It's drawing in the fourth and fifth fingers in quite a sort of a claw-type fashion. Not specific to liver disease, but very common in liver disease. The nail beds and the nails are important. Clubbing, again, very non-specific. And I don't see it very often, to be honest, in cirrhosis. You'll look for leukonychia, but it's very subjective. Subjective, that's white nails. And again, you can compare it to your own. You may pick up the more generalized signs as well, such as jaundice or even scratching on the back of the hands from pruritus. So those are the main hand signs. As we're talking about the hands, we should talk about asterixis or the metabolic or liver flap. When we're done with the hands, often I ask the patient to raise their hands and sort of point to the ceiling with their fingers, and that's when you might pick up asterixis or tremor. But asterixis is a classic sort of low frequency flapping, which is a problem with the patient's sort of sense of proprioception, where they correct themselves because of sort of neuromuscular drift. But I think those are the main things to look at in the upper limb.
Yeah, fantastic. And Phil, I wonder if you could just expand on asterixis for just a moment. Is asterixis a specific sign for a decompensation, or can we often find that as a sign in patients who have well compensated liver disease?
Yeah, by the usual grading systems of encephalopathy, it's usually under grade 2, between 0 and 4. So you'd normally be pretty poorly to have grade 2 asterixis. I do see it in patients who are mentating completely normally. So I think it's sort of grade 1 stroke grade 2. And if there's somebody around who happens to be conveniently admitted or chronically encephalopathic with that sign, they may come to the exam. And even if they don't have it, if you look for it, you might start a conversation about it, you know, with the examiner in the wrap-up. So it's good to know about it. So essentially, grade 1 to grade 2 asterixis, but in my experience, it can sometimes exist, you know, in isolation as well. It's not just hepatic. You can get it in hypercapnia, raised CO2, and other metabolic disorders as well.
Fantastic. And so moving from the hands up the arms, you've already mentioned a couple of things there about scratching in the arms as an extra sign. And then there's a couple of other signs which may be, again, sort of non-specific, but we may find in the arms of these patients as well. Well, one of the things which I was thinking of in the arms is bruising to suggest sort of almost spontaneous coagulopathy associated with liver disease.
Yeah, now that certainly relates to, you know, all of the skin, but you do see it, you know, especially if they scratch and they've got low platelets or coagulopathy or just weak tissues. You know, a paper thin skin is a sign of chronic liver disease as well. And you just get that sort of fragility around the skin and certainly bruising. I agree, from venipuncture, from bleeding after cannulas, and from just, you know, bumps and knocks with low platelets. Absolutely, you're absolutely right there. Tattoos is important in terms of as a potential risk factor for acquisition of viral hepatitis. Now, in reality, how often do a tattooed patients end up having hepatitis C or hepatitis B from non-sterile equipment? Very few, but it shows that your Sherlock Holmes methods are working if you actively look for these things and comment on them. The more informal tattoos that could have been done, you know, outside a registered location are important, or if they're done abroad, etc., on a holiday, it's quite possible they could have been a route for viral transmission.
Yeah, brilliant. And then moving from the arms, we're going to go up to the face and neck of our patients, and this is where we're going to need to do some close inspection, maybe something which we not quite as possible to see from the end of the bed, where we're going to have to look a bit more closely. But what possible signs might be evident in the face or the neck of our patient?
Yeah, so I think at this time we're beginning to look in the eyes for more objective signs of anemia, look in the conjunctiva, the tongue. You may find jaundice, which is restricted only to the sclera. Jaundice tends to sort of clear more slowly from the sclera than the skin. And so it could be sort of residual from a jaundiced episode. So have a careful look there. As a gastroenterologist, I always look in the mouth for ulceration or tongue signs, but that's not specifically liver, but it's good practice. And then around the side of the neck, it's a great catch out if someone's got right heart failure causing hepatomegaly, which we'll talk about in a minute. But if they do have a high JVP or you can pick up an abnormality there, then it's definitely worth looking for. And also lymphadenopathy. Again, I think as part of a general examination, lymphadenopathy is really important for the possibility of malignancy related to the GI tract or lymphoma or any other, you know, chronic inflammatory or infective disorder.
Yeah, brilliant. And of course, lymphadenopathy is not just confined to the neck. That may be something which you look for in the axilla as well when we come to examine the chest of our patient. And there are several other signs in the chest which, again, purely on inspection rather than palpation or auscultation, as we're maybe more conventionally expected to do in a respiratory or cardiovascular examination. But there are some things on simple inspection of the chest of a patient with chronic liver disease which can give a strong indication that, again, there's liver pathology implicated.
Yeah, spider nevi is a classic. You're allowed, you know, a couple more as a female because they're driven by estrogen and their effect on cutaneous capillaries. But it's very likely that a cirrhosis patient will have noticeable spider nevi, and pressing them in the middle to get that sort of centripetal blanching is a classic sign. Some of them are quite large or even prominent and palpable rather than just visible. Gynecomastia is really important in male patients. It's probably far more common than we think. The disc of breast tissue can be enlarged or tender mainly because of the underlying liver disease itself and the effect it has on estrogen breakdown. But if patients are on aldosterone inhibiting diuretics such as spironolactone, you can get gynecomastia from that as well. Brings us into the sort of feminization signs, the scarcity of body hair, and later on perhaps testicular atrophy, which probably no one's going to look for, but you can mention that you might examine the genitalia for completeness. The overall appearance of the skin is important in classic hemochromatosis, but again, very unlikely that we'll find a patient with iron deposition in the skin, but that sort of browny, grayy color can be seen. And if you're asked why you're looking at the skin, then that's a good one to come up with. Bronze diabetes is one of the manifestations of hemochromatosis, diabetes and a bronze color. So it's worth knowing that.
Yep, brilliant. So hopefully by this point in their examination, the candidates will already have a fairly clear idea that they've picked up on various signs associated with liver disease. And so coming to the abdomen, they're really going to need to have their routine pinned down to ensure that they're going to maximize their marks from the key part of the examination, which is coming to the abdomen of their patient. So again, Phil, if we come to the inspection, so without even laying a hand on the patient yet, the first thing will be to just expose and position the patient appropriately, which ideally in the when you come to examine the abdomen should be flat on their back, should be supine. And before they even lay a hand on their patient, what should our listeners be looking out for, again, just on general inspection of the abdomen?
Yeah, I mean, look for distension. You don't know that's going to be ascites, but it's likely to be. More unusually, you'll get sort of asymmetrical distension or protuberances from gross organomegaly. That's less likely. Scratches are really common. You know, you tend to scratch your stomach if you've got itch, and you often see these lines of scratches in the lower abdomen. You may pick up jaundice, which you've missed before. If there are any dressings on the abdomen or small bruises from recent acidic taps or drains, it's definitely worth noting. These patients may well have been in hospital for a few days or coming in regularly for acidic drains, and they will have telltale scars where the catheters have gone in, maybe even stitch marks if the catheters have been stitched in for a few days. There is the possibility of visibly distended abdominal veins. Now, I think they are difficult because a lot of people have distended abdominal veins without having the classic caput medusae. The caput medusae are the dilated veins that appear to come out, radiate out from the umbilical area, which are due to portal hypertension and portosystemic shunting. And if the examiners are lucky enough to have a patient with that, then they'll definitely bring them along. So yeah, that's just looking at the abdomen. Obviously, scars could be relevant in anybody who's had an intervention, classically a liver transplant or another form of transplantation.
Now it comes to the actual point where we come to palpate the abdomen. And I think this is something which a lot of PACES candidates really struggle to do without sufficient experience of examining abdomens on a routine basis. And this is where your practice of examining pathological abdomens with organomegaly is really going to come in. The examination routine is well documented. You're going to palpate generally for tenderness, but palpating for masses is going to be most important here. So Phil, I wonder if you can give us your best tips with regard, particularly for palpating for organomegaly, which is going to really make or break our listeners' stations, because I think this is going to be a pretty a hard sign where potentially missing it could spell disaster for the station if you report this incorrectly. So what would your advice be with regard to the best tips for reliably and consistently correctly palpating for organomegaly?
I mean, the challenge is maintaining your attention on what your hands are feeling while maintaining your attention on the patient and being considerate to the patient. So you don't want to dive in. You don't want to have your eyes on the back of your hands and missing the wincing, you know, wide open eyes of the worried or uncomfortable patient. So that takes practice, and that takes, you know, some time to become natural there. But at the end of the day, you want to be able to pick up what your hands are feeling and believe what your hands are feeling. If you feel something, it's probably there. You know, it's not, if there's something hard underneath the skin, then believe what you're feeling. So start with making sure the patient's comfortable and exposed to a reasonable, you know, with the clothing down to the hips. Make sure they're in a decent position. Tell them what you're going to do. And start with light palpation in all four quadrants. That is to make sure they're not tender, and also to give you a general feeling as to where you're going with this examination, because you'll already feel some fullness in the right upper quadrant if there's gross hepatomegaly, or more generally if there's splenomegaly or other masses. Then go for a deeper palpation in all four quadrants. You get lots of advice about how often you should palpate. You know, I think two or three times, two or three passes with your hand, because otherwise it just looks like you're not sure and you're not picking up any further information, and you do want to be somewhat slick at this. And then, having done all four quadrants and not picked up any obvious abnormalities, usually you'll be zoning in on the organomegaly itself, and the place to start is with the liver, and that's where you place your hand down in the right lower quadrant, nice and low, to make sure you don't accidentally put your hand on top of the liver and then move up, in which case you'll never feel the edge. So you gently depress and you gently pull the edge of your hand upwards towards the rib cage and ask the patient to breathe in. And you keep on doing that, moving up a centimeter or two at a time until you get up to the costal margin. And if there is a liver edge, it should come down and meet the edge of your finger as you're doing that when the patient breathes in. And that's where you need to be keeping your eye on the patient, because if they do have hepatomegaly, it could be tender and they might wince when you touch it. Could be gallbladder as well, of course, less likely. If there was a gallbladder in a jaundice patient, then you'd be thinking of Courvoisier sign, which is gallbladder distension in painless jaundice. Then if you do hit a liver edge, you need to characterize it quite quickly. It's usually going to be smooth in a liver disease patient. The knobbly, irregular liver in cirrhosis is quite usually small, but it is sometimes large. If you feel irregularity of the liver border, think about malignancy, but that is probably less likely in an exam. And then, having felt the liver edge, you need to trace it to work out the extent, and does it go to the midline, does it go beyond, and just swiftly characterize the shape of the liver. I mean, normally, although it's not part of palpation, I would, in the interest of slickness, I would begin to think about percussing over the rib cage when you've picked up hepatomegaly. So come down from the breast area and percuss down until you get dullness, and that'll give you some sense of where the liver starts. Having done the liver, you will then think about the spleen, and that's where you start in the same place as you did for the liver in the right lower quadrant, but you move up diagonally towards the left upper quadrant, and you ask the patient to breathe in. And it's worth going to the effort of asking the patient to roll over onto their right side, so that it makes the spleen fall down towards you. Now, splenomegaly is quite unusual, and it would normally be seen in a hematology type patient, I think, rather than a liver patient. Palpable splenomegaly and cirrhosis is quite unusual. There's usually something else going on. Obviously, while you're in the abdomen, you will think about examining for the kidneys as well, and thinking about confirming ascites by eliciting shifting dullness, where you determine the level of fluid, and then you ask the patient to roll away from you, and see if it becomes resonant as the fluid falls down to the lower part of the abdomen. But that's how I do it. The general clue is to keep thinking about the patient, though. Talk to them, make it look natural, make sure you're not causing pain.
Yeah, absolutely. It would be a real shame to, you know, pick up the marks for the correct detection of signs and then lose it on patient welfare instead because you've made the patient uncomfortable. Absolutely right. And so you'll palpate for all of the organs, as Phil's mentioned, check for shifting dullness, and then you'll come to listen to the abdomen, you'll auscultate. I can't think of anything in particular that I'd be auscultating for, particularly with regard to chronic liver disease, Phil.
Yeah, it's normally classically over the liver to see if there's any sort of hum from a very well vascularized tumor. Again, vanishingly unusual, but it is part of the formal examination. You, if you had a patient, you know, with an acute abdomen and thinking about bowel obstruction, obviously you would listen to the abdomen as well to see if there are any bowel sounds or any tinkling sounds. But this is where it's quite difficult for candidates. If they're not 100% sure what the point of the case is, and you normally would be from the suggestions that are made, then you need to, how far do you tailor your examination? You don't want to do things that are completely irrelevant to the direction the examination is going in. But as long as there's a justification for it, that's fine. And I think it's reasonable to auscultate over the liver, although, as I say, very unusual to find a positive thing there. Just going back to the liver, it's worth bearing in mind what we said at the beginning about heart failure and right heart failure. In theory, you might detect a pulsatile liver edge, and you might be able to elicit a hepatojugular reflex if you press up on the liver gently but firmly and see if the JVP changes and becomes more prominent. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do if you've got that suspicion.
Yeah, fantastic. And then moving down from the abdomen, we'll come to the legs of our patient, which is routinely is near to the end of the examination. And I mean, more generally, as we've just mentioned, heart failure, pitting peripheral edema is going to be important to look for, but also might be reflective of hypoalbuminemia as well, Phil.
Yes, absolutely. So edema is a sign of chronic liver disease, probably multifactorial to be fair, but you will definitely want to look for that. This clearly could be related to absorption as well, or recent, you know, acute illness and resuscitation. But it's definitely a sign, in the same way that ascites is a sign, you have excess fluid, excess total body water, and some of that will be in the legs. It may even go all the way up to the thighs and the waist. It's very common for someone with ascites to be, you know, globally have global edema that responds usually to diuretics.
Yeah, fantastic. And then the next thing will be more or less coming to the end of the examination, but you may well have some time to spare. Usually in that time, you'd fill it by mentioning the things which are probably not maybe wholly appropriate to do in an exam style setting. So one of the things you mentioned was an external genitalia examination for testicular atrophy, the feminization signs that you mentioned. And there are some things which I've put down here, which are more sort of medical school habits rather than anything else. So a digital rectal examination, examination of hernial orifices, and a urine dip. Those are sort of the things which I used to remember from, you know, your medical school finals. Are these reasonable things to sort of mention to the examiner as a bit of routine, Phil?
Yeah, I think you want to show that you're thinking beyond what you're seeing. You're going to the next stage. You're a doctor in ED. You're thinking, okay, I've met this patient for the first time on the ward or in the ED. Where am I going with this? And a rectal examination could be very relevant to a patient with chronic liver disease because of gastrointestinal bleeding. So you're not doing it for prostatic hypertrophy. You're not doing it for, you know, rectal carcinoma. You're doing it because you want to make sure they haven't had a variceal hemorrhage. So that's very, very relevant. The hernial orifices, not so relevant. Testicular atrophy in real day, everyday practice, we don't palpate for that, but it's worth mentioning. And urine dip is useful, especially if there's edema. You're interested to know whether you could be barking up the wrong tree and they've got nephrotic syndrome.
Yeah, absolutely. And so after you've concluded your examination, we're going to be turning to the examiner and presenting our case back to the examiner and explaining the signs that we found that will justify our suspected diagnosis of chronic liver disease. And so the sort of, it's important to have a structure with your presentation. So Phil, maybe you can critique my approach because this is the way that I did it. So my first step was identify the signs that have led you to believe the patient has chronic liver disease. And I mean, this is quite pretty obvious, but also the difficulty here is that you're going to probably have multiple signs. We've mentioned plenty through the course of this conversation already, and mentioning as many signs as possible as you can remember. And in PACES, one important principle is that you don't state a sign which is not relevant. So whilst you might have detected many signs, you're not going to make up the fact that the patient, for example, has scleral jaundice when they don't, even though it may be consistent with your diagnosis. So hopefully that's nice and obvious that you're just going to state the signs which have led you to your diagnosis. And then the next thing, which Phil, I wonder if you can jump in on is as well, is whether or not the patient has compensated or decompensated liver disease. So which of the signs that we've discussed already would lead you to think that this patient is probably compensated, and then what would be the signs that they are potentially on the verge of decompensated liver disease?
Yeah, I think if you talk about compensation, you're demonstrating that you understand a bit more hepatology than just cirrhosis or no cirrhosis. And it's easier to talk about what are the signs of decompensation. Many of the signs of chronic liver disease are not related to the current degree of synthetic liver dysfunction. But decompensation is where it just can't handle everyday life anymore. And so you begin to see the consequences of that. And those consequences are jaundice, any degree of jaundice in the eyes, on the skin. Those consequences include excess body water, sodium retention. So that's ascites and edema. Encephalopathy is another sign of decompensation, likely largely related to ammonia and its handling in the brain. And any signs of encephalopathy, slow speech, confusion, disorientation, asterixis, will be a sign of decompensation. And bleeding is the other major form of decompensation. But those are the classic signs that the liver is not only cirrhotic, which many people can have and be walking down the high street with no real visible signs to the bystander. The decompensation occurs when you get those one or more of that package of signs and symptoms. So fluid, jaundice, bleeding, confusion, stroke, encephalopathy, and those are the signs of decompensation.
It's that time of the show again where we shout out PASTEST for their fantastic PACES resource. As you guys surely will know by now, PASTEST has a fantastic range of practice videos for you to watch to sharpen you up before your exam day, some of which are closely related to this episode of Chronic Liver Disease. So to get access to those videos and many more, just click any of the links in the show notes. Now back to our chat with Dr. Phil Berry. Yeah, fantastic. And then the next thing, which is going to be critically important and we'll be coming on to talk about in more detail, is suggesting an underlying etiology. And this is really where you're going to be trying as best you can to flex your differential diagnostic skills. It may be quite difficult in PACES because obviously you don't have the luxury of being able to take a history, which we do in clinical practice. But Phil, are there any clinical signs during our examination which may indicate an etiology to our listeners as they go through their examination?
I think this is difficult and sensitive. The PACES mindset is very much to caricature stories and patients. And somebody with a higher body mass index on the couch doesn't necessarily have non-alcoholic steatohepatitis and NASH cirrhosis. But you've got to go with what you can see. So you could say, you know, I believe this patient has chronic liver disease and has signs of cirrhosis, plus or minus decompensation. There's a wide differential diagnosis here. However, what may be relevant to this particular patient is central adiposity, waist circumference, high body mass index. If there's any clues in the in any information given to you about metabolic syndrome, blood pressure, diabetes, gout, insulin resistance, hyperlipidemia, dyslipidemia, then they will build into that potential diagnosis. And NAFLD, NASH, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, is incredibly common and has always got to be on the list, I think. The viral hepatitis, you can't say. You may find a tattoo, but as I said earlier on, there's no real connection generally. And the patient's ethnicity cannot really be used in that story, although viral hepatitis is more common in some areas, hepatitis B in Asia, for instance, and Africa through vertical transmission. And then you're into the alcohol, which is very difficult without taking a history, but incredibly common. So you've always got to throw that in there as a possibility. And then you're going to get into your narrower, more small print and rare diagnoses, which you might be able to bring forward if, for instance, you've got someone who fits the typical profile for primary biliary cholangitis, for instance, you know, a younger or middle-aged female patient, or autoimmune hepatitis, or hemochromatosis, which we mentioned earlier on. You know, you'll be lucky to pick up a confirmatory information from how the patient appears. You would need more information to really sort of pin it to those diagnoses. Bear in mind the malignancy question. It's not impossible to misinterpret a patient with malignancy for someone with cirrhosis. We've all done it. So, you know, if there was hepatomegaly with any irregularity, then you've got to consider that, especially if there was a complicating hepatocellular carcinoma, for instance.
Yeah, fantastic. And I guess the other thing to mention, which again we wouldn't have without a thorough history, is drugs.
Yeah,
of which there are many culprits. I'm sure we'll come on to talk about that a little bit later when we talk about differential diagnosis. In fact, we could just talk about it now, to be honest, because I think that's more or less the approach that we would take. So just to recap very quickly, is state the signs which you believe which have led you to believe the patient has chronic liver disease, express an opinion on level of decompensation. Is there evidence that this is a decompensated liver disease? And then, if possible, try and have a stab at the etiology. But again, as Phil says, it is difficult without taking a history and without having more information. Lastly, I mean, we'll talk about drugs as a possible cause, which, aside from having a box of medications at the bedside, I think would be difficult. But what are the most common drugs which lead to significant liver dysfunction in your experience?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of acute liver dysfunction related to medications. But in terms of the long-term use resulting in cirrhosis, it's a really changing field. You know, methotrexate was the classic, but there's a lot of debate now as to whether methotrexate is genuinely related to liver fibrosis. And looking back over a lot of evidence, I think it was over-interpreted, the relevance of methotrexate. It may well be a stronger association with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease in those patients, but I still think it's worth discussing. So methotrexate, so if you've seen in your examination that there are signs of a rheumatological disorder, rheumatoid arthritis, then definitely bring that in. Amiodarone is a cause of chronic liver disease, but we don't see it very often. They will clearly have that for cardiac reasons and might have an irregular pulse. You'll be lucky to make that link, but it's worth mentioning. Antituberculous drugs generally, you know, cause acute liver dysfunction, and a whole myriad of medications, you know, antibiotics and biologics, anti-inflammatories cause acute liver dysfunction, but don't really result in fibrosis and cirrhosis. So I think the drugs is not something to really dwell on in terms of the statistical chance of it being relevant, unless you are being thrown a clue that there's definitely a drug, you know, in the story somewhere.
Brilliant. And the only thing to say to our listeners is that having the common causes of chronic liver disease at the tip of your tongue for the exam is of critical importance. We know that this is something which comes up so commonly, and preparing for this station, for an abdominal examination station, is absolutely one of the most important stations. So these are the types of answers you need to have at the tip of your tongue. What are the commonest causes of chronic liver disease? And then, as Phil's already talked about, the reasons or signs which might indicate that that a patient has become decompensated.
I think it's helpful to have a little way of approaching that. You know, we talked about alcohol, talked about non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Just for information, just this month, they've changed the nomenclature of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and it's become rather complicated, but it's going to be called metabolic associated steatotic liver disease. And there are some other subcategories. But if anybody wants to be really up to date, go and look up the publications from this month, June 23, around the renaming of NAFLD. It's quite interesting. So alcohol, NAFLD, viral hepatitis, and then the helpful way of thinking about it is metabolic and autoimmune. So metabolic is going to be hemochromatosis and Wilson's, and the autoimmune mediated is going to be autoimmune hepatitis, primary biliary cholangitis, and primary sclerosing cholangitis, which we haven't talked about. And those are the five main categories. Don't forget alpha-1 antitrypsin as well. Probably put that in the metabolic, especially if they've got chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. But I think if you can remember those five broad categories, that'll see you through.
So that brings us to the end of this episode, looking at the examination, presentation, and differential diagnosis of chronic liver disease. Next time, we complete our conversation with consultant hepatologist Dr. Phil Berry and talk through the investigations and management of this important condition. Not only that, but Phil tackles his Quiz the Consultant topic of Star Wars, which is absolutely essential listening, even if I say so myself. So without further ado, that's just about all the time we have for this week's show. Don't forget to like, follow, subscribe to the show, or leave a 5-star review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We always love to hear from you, so give us a shout on our Twitter. It's at Prepaces Podcast. If you really want to go above and beyond and support the show, it's buymeacoffee.com/prepacespodcast. But for now, we are just about out of time. Thank you for listening. I've been Dr. Sam Williams, and we will see you next time on the Prepaces Podcast.